shoved aside the cotton padding, and saw a medicine bag. It was old, ancient. It was the bag I wore in my soul home. I knew instantly that it was my father's. Green dyed leather on one side, rougher rawhide on the other. Much like Aya's, but so old it was dry rotten. It should have been buried with him, or given to his eldest child. Me. Oh, I breathed, and caught his scent. Tobacco, sweetgrass, cedar, the faint but still present scent of the Nantahala River. Tears raced down my face. I touched the bag, and though the edges were crumbling, the center was still pliable enough to take the slight weight. There were hard things inside. A bone, a quartz crystal.
Unilisi put something in it for you, for when you're ready.
I nodded. Not ready. Not ready just now. Maybe not ever. Thank you, I whispered. At the house, I leaped out and raced through a sudden deluge to the door. Soaked to the skin, I worked the lock as my brother drove off into the storm. Lightning cracked down, one of the ubiquitous lightning storms of the Deep South. I finally got the lock open and dashed inside into chaos and screaming and commotion. Edmund, up after dawn, probably only because of the storm and the darkness it gave the day, and Eli were fighting a woman, both men covered in blood, as were the walls and the floor. With the two of them fighting together, they should have killed an attacker in the first 2 seconds. And they hadn't. Yet this wasn't a sparring match. It was too bloody for that. Their opponent was a blonde vamp, all claws and talons in rage. It was a testament to my exhaustion that I didn't even blink at the brawl, though did think that it would be a pain in the butt to get blood off the walls, again. But I did smell lemons. I opened my mouth and let the flavor of her blood flow over my tongue and the roof of my mouth as I slouched in the entry, watching, trying to remember the vamp. And then it hit me. Bruiser's scion, Nicole. I frowned, not able to remember her last name, if I'd ever heard it. Bruiser had drained her energies and taken her memories and then gifted her to Ed. I had no idea where Ed had been keeping her, but somewhere not close enough. Someone had gotten to her and claimed her for Clan des Citrons. I parsed the scents, smelling lemons and the sharp, sour, stagnant pond scent of madness. Her wrists and ankles bore ligature scars the way vamp's skin looked when it had been burned by silver.
"Where is she?" Nicole screamed. "I'll rip her heart out."
I figured she meant me. Just wild guess. Ed vaulted across the kitchen table, his talons ripping at her. More blood on the walls. Crap. If the Lemon Clan set her free and tracked her, then they knew where she lived. If she had gotten away, which her scarring suggested, then if I shifted to Bloodhound, I could follow her back to them. If I was willing to risk losing myself to the hunt and never finding myself again, becoming Bloodhound was dangerous. Beast thought at me, "Ugly dog. Good nose. Do not want to be ugly dog tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow." I slid my hands into the slits in my clothing and pulled weapons. A wood stake and a semi-automatic 9mm. It was loaded with regular ammo, but it should slow her down. Nicole was a youngish vamp, and they tended to be less resistant to weapons of all kinds. I hesitated, remembering the path of blood Aggie had shown that I was treading. But I wasn't killing. I was swatting down a crazy-ass vamp. "Nicole!" I shouted. Everything stopped. And then Nicole leaped at me, totally vamped out. I raised the gun and fired. Mid-center body mass. She didn't die, but she did scream, that awful ululation of a vamp dying, or thinking they are. She dropped to the ground, landing in a 3-point balance, a tripod, both feet in one hand. When she thrust herself up, I stabbed low into her belly, hitting her descending aorta, or whatever passed as such for vamps. She fell, lay there paralyzed, leaking onto the wood floors. If our house was ever a crime scene, the cops would think the place had been the home base of a couple dozen mass murderers. Ed and Eli fell back, exhausted. Ed pushed off his perch almost instantly and went to Eli. "Let me heal you." My second set his weapons on the kitchen table for cleaning and pulled off his t-shirt. His dark chest was scored with talon marks and too much blood. Ed sliced his fingers with his blade and went to work healing the bleeding mess. Neither man looked at me. "Somebody want to tell me what's happening?" I asked. Edmund huffed softly through his nose. I was pretty sure he was breathing to make up for the battle and his own blood loss.
"She came in through the back, over the brick wall. From Katie's."
Fear slammed through me. I turned that way and Ed said,
"Dion called. Everyone is fine. He locked the girls in the kitchen and threw holy water on Nicole."
I towed her over and spotted a scald on her shoulder and neck. Nicole glared at me. It was all she could do with the ash wood in her belly. That and leak. "And she wanted to kill you," Eli said.
"Natch?"
Natch was my word, and I shook my head at him.
"She was dropped off at Katie's by a dark SUV," Alex said. "Plates reported stolen an hour ago."
I shifted my body forward to see him and Bo Dak coming out of the laundry room where they had taken shelter. The kid was armed with a handgun. Bo Dak was carrying a broom and was more pasty than usual. He also stank of fear.
"No way to track her back to the enemy," Alex said.
"Is there always this much blood?" Bo Dak asked, his voice shaky.
"This is nothing," Alex said, his voice light but his eyes hard, maybe remembering his own near death.
"Alex, please call for the council house's cleanup crew."
Ed bent and lifted Nicole into his arms, which must have shifted the position of the stake in her belly because she swiveled her head to me in one of those not-human moves that's a lot more like a lizard or a bird than a mammal.
"George is mine," she whispered,
the smell of the lye on her breath, leaking from her with her blood and the scent of lemons.
"We love each other. We have been lovers for weeks."
When I didn't react, she shouted,
"He's mine!"
"She's been turned by Des Citrons," I said. "We need to know where they are, how many they are, what their plans are." Edmund hesitated as if weighing my unspoken command to drink her down.
"I will discover all that she knows, my mistress, assuming that she knows anything at all."
That sounded as if he agreed with my unspoken request, so that was good.
"Roseanne Romanello has decided not to participate in the Sangre Duello. Therefore, I will have Nicole shipped to Sedona at sunset."
Nicole screamed,
"No!"
Ed carried her deeper into the living room, where he opened the hidden door into his sun-protected hidey hole and slipped inside. The shelving unit closed behind him, cutting off her scream. "Eli?" I asked.
"I'm good. Could have used a few more minutes with the fanged healer, but it's after sunrise."
He looked out the window at the drenching rain before he started up the stairs. I followed, taking in his back. In the human world, he would have needed stitches. Maybe a lot of stitches. In the ranger world, in the world of vamps, not so much.
"What?"
he said to me, as if he could tell I was staring at his wounds. "Ed missed some. You need an urgent care center."
"Why don't you just put pressure on it all and tape me up? Ed can heal me tonight. It'll be more expedient than a trip to urgent care."
Expedient was Eli's word, used whenever I wanted him to get medical care. Home remedies were more expedient than drugs. Pressure and butterfly bandages were more expedient than stitches. "Dumb man," I said. Eli shrugged, which made him bleed faster, and led the way to his bathroom. I pulled the covers over my head, hearing rain scudding against the windows, not thinking, not feeling. But I rolled back and lifted the boxing gloves off the bedpost, snuggling with them under the covers, breathing deeply of Onorio scent, wishing I could tell Bruiser about the sweat house and the revelations of my past, wishing he was here with me, holding me. Dreams dragged me under. Bruiser texted me after 1 p.m. with the words, "Lunch, my place. Not cooking, but got goodies. We'll send a car." Subtext, he'll send a car instead of worrying that I'd walk and confront a killer again. The shooter, if there had been one aiming for him or me, or both of us, the last time I took a walk, was still missing. The lemon-smelling one. Right. I texted back, "Send car in 15. I'd had nowhere near enough sleep, but the 5+ hours would have to do. Besides, I needed to tell him about Nicole's attack and see what Alex had on Clan de Citron. I hung the boxing gloves back on the bedpost and crawled out of bed. I threw on jeans and boots and a leather jacket. It was almost cool enough in Nola for my traditional winter wear. I kept weapons to a minimum, a couple of stakes, a short-bladed silver-plated knife in my boot, and a single holster shoulder harness with an old but trusty H&K. Left my hair down. I was ready 10 minutes before the car was due, and so I woke up Alex, who was asleep on the couch. Update. Alex made a noise that could have come from a 70-year-old woman as he sat up and woke his electronics. "I got more vid of the car that picked up Dominique at HQ. One was a security cam shot of the car. I felt something settle heavily in my midsection, right above my vaunted gut. And," I asked softly, "Brivet la Gaillarde, France, is the hunting territory of the blood master of Clan de Citron. Her name is Julieta Tempest, and she came to the U.S. on a tourist visa 2 months ago. She was sucking face with Dominique in the getaway car." "Last known address?" I asked. "Charleston, South Carolina. But I tracked one of her credit cards to a Hampton Inn off I-10 4 days ago. She checked out, probably in town now. Probably sent people ahead to gather up any dissatisfied local fangheads. I've put a ping on her credit card use. If she shows up, I'll let you know, and get as much of the video of her entourage as possible, with IDs and dossiers. But I got more. Go on." "There was another face in the SUV. Crowded. Right. And the face was someone you fought before. Bansom Mlare." I'd staked Sim, but she had gotten away. I should have found her again and taken her head, hindsight and all that. Regret was a bitch. I'm betting Dominique took her off the battlefield when I killed Shafru and healed her. Then they swore to the Lemonheads. Probably working with the enemy from the very beginning," Alex said. "Thanks, kid. Bodat?" I nudged him awake where he snored in a chair. "Either shower or you can move the desk to the back porch." "I bathed yesterday." "Day before, dude," Alex said. Bodat sighed and headed for the stairs. "Hey, kid," I said. Alex turned his head to me again. "You done good." Alex grinned with pride and tilted his head at me in a gesture that was pure Eli. It was still raining when I got to Bruiser's third-floor apartment. I knocked before opening the door and towing out of the Lucchese boots I had pulled on against the rain. The music was turned down low, something bluesy and jazzy all at once, and the place smelled heavenly. Bruiser smelled even better when he opened his arms and I exhaled against his chest, sort of melting into him. I was tall, too skinny, but solid muscle and stronger than most men thanks to my skinwalker abilities. But Bruiser was bigger and taller, and though I was capable of taking care of myself, he always made me feel safer. And there was something about a man in a soft flannel shirt and worn-out jeans that hyped up the comfort level for me. "Are you well, love?" I'm just Ducky, and you smell fabulous. I felt his mouth curl up against the side of my head.
I have smoked salmon, butternut squash soup made with white wine, 3 flavors of goat cheese, and bruschetta.
Sorry.
What?
I zoned out after smoked salmon. He chuckled and took my hand, leading me to the kitchen and the tall white leather stools that fronted the island. It was cool today, and Bruiser had kept the tall French doors closed on the temps and the rain, so it was cozy in the apartment. He poured me a glass of white wine, ladled steaming butternut squash soup into big soup bowls, and set one in front of me. He was doing the 3-course meal thing, probably is the only way to get me to eat anything more than the meat. Tears filled my eyes. I blinked them away, but not before he saw them, or smelled them.
Jane, alarm in his tone.
But I held up my hand and shook my head. I'm good, just sleep-deprived and tired and I feel so grateful, happy. I reached over and took his hands, squeezing them as I bowed my head, saying a silent thanks. Wordlessly, I listed the ways my life was better, richer, happier. Tears scalded down my face as I silently prayed. When I stopped, he said softly,
"And I am eternally thankful for Jane Yellow Rock in my life. Amen."
I lifted my eyes to his and was startled to see tears pooled there, mirroring my own. Except I was all salty and snotty and splotched, I was sure, and he was still gorgeous.
There was a time when I believed that I was nothing in life without the Mithrins, without my position with Leo, that without his blood I'd be useless and lacking in value of any sort. And then I met you. A woman with enough power to stand against him, tall and strong and vibrant, without being dependent on drinking blood.
He kissed my knuckles, released one hand, and lifted his glass in a toast.
You give me courage to be Onorio, to Jane Yellowrock,
and to us. I toasted back and drank, and said, "Holy crap, this is good." I sipped again. I actually like this one. It's really, really good. I had no wine-type words to describe it.
Buttery, Bruiser said. You always like buttery whites. It's excellent with the soup.
I sopped my face with a cloth napkin and spooned some soup into my mouth. I wasn't fond of squash, but this stuff was different. Apples. It has apples in it, and something green and sweet, and chicken stock.
Anise.
Bruiser said. He was trying to share with me his own appreciation of wine and fine food.
It's from the anise or fennel plant.
I placed the cloth in my lap, slung my loose hair out of the way, and sat like the lady one of the house mothers had tried to make me. I like it. We ate and ate. And when the soup was gone and the wine bottle was empty and the salmon was picked down to the bones, Bruiser took a warm towel and wiped my hands clean. The towel smelled of oranges, and so did his mouth when he kissed me and led me to the couch.
Sit. We need to talk and work for a bit.
Yada yada. He sat beside me and pulled a soft fuzzy blanket over us.
Yada. He agreed. But I can rub your feet while we chat.
You are the best boyfriend ever. He took my feet and gently squeezed them.
You first.
I started with the easy stuff, telling him about Aya and Aggie One Feather, the usual debrief stuff. But there's something else. The kid tracked Julieta Tempest. She came to the U.S. on a tourist visa 2 months ago. Alex is trying to track her.
Clan de Citron. Does Leo know?
He asked. I texted him an update. His fingers worked the kinks out of my feet as he thought it through. Bruiser frowned, the lines on either side of his nose pulling down. Those lines had become deeper with worry and with the problems that piled up against us. His frown softened.
My turn.
He told me stuff I didn't half listen to. Leo got a letter in the mail from the Carusos. The old funeral home directors. The ones who created Revenants and the Revenant concoction?
Yes. The letter was held by their attorneys here in New Orleans and mailed when it became clear that Titus Flavius Vespianus would come ashore. They acted against Leo for decades and left under duress because Laurie's daughter was being held by Titus. They deliberately left that bottle of Titus's secret Revenant potion in their fridge for Leo to find.
Deliberately? Are we supposed to fall for that?
The lawyer agreed to be bled and read by Leo. He believes it to be true. Leo wants us to save the entire Caruso family if possible, if he wins the Sangre Duello.
Easy peasy. Not? Bruiser smiled slightly.
Katie is in Atlanta. She invaded the lairs of a dozen Mithrins, and Ash staked them in their sleep, disabling them. Then she dragged them to a room filled with silver-plated Scion prisons. She'll start her own negotiations tonight.
Katie did that in the daytime. I enunciated the last word. Because vampires.
Katie slept in the blood of 8 clans. She will be the strongest Mithrin in the Americas for quite some time.
Meaning that if she wanted Leo's position, she could have it.
Indeed.
He kneaded harder into the arch of my foot. I might have moaned.
You have very talented fingers.
I do, and I'll take you to bed and prove it soon.
His fingers pressed and rolled and crept and knuckled up my calf to a sensitive spot in the middle of my calf. Oh, holy moly.
Meanwhile, Lawrence is recuperating.
When I got an eyelid to open and looked blank, he said,
Lawrence Hefner, Leo's valet, injured in the were-attack, trying to save Leo.
I nodded, closing my eyes. Lack of sleep was catching up to me.
He hates being called Larry. He has protested being in bed with Gilles de Merci, most vociferously. Leo found it necessary to promise to skin G alive if he so much as tried anything of a sexual nature with Lawrence.
G would still try something, something innocuous, just to give Larry a hard time. I smiled and stretched to give Bruiser access to the tendon on the outside of my other foot. Leo told me about the potential 3 islands for the duel, I said. But what happens if the negotiations with Titus end up with us all in international waters, on a boat, instead of on land? Wouldn't that leave Nola open for a coup d'etat?
Not if Edmund is left on shore.
My breathing almost stopped at that.
Edmund,
Leo's heir, one of the top vamp fighters in the United States. That's why Leo made Edmund his official heir, to protect New Orleans, I said.
And you, the Dark Queen.
Bruiser said quietly, his fingers stopping to simply hold my feet.
Between the two of you, with your ability to time walk, you could protect the city and her people.
He's planning to leave me ashore if an island isn't chosen. Son of a gun. I didn't know, I said, just as softly, touching my belly and the faint pain there. Indigestion, maybe. I didn't understand that move on the chessboard. Making me DQ wasn't because he's selfish. It was because he's... I stopped. No way I was going to say Leo Pellissier was a good man. A good king.
Yes, he is.
There was something soft and sad in his tone, as if he wished Leo had been a better man, too. But if Titus knows all this about Ed and me, that we could hold the city, then... I opened both eyes and said, then what?
Then he won't push to have the fight in the water, but on land, land that Leo owns, or at least has some appearance of owning. Titus will want to kill you, Edmund, and Leo at the duello.
I closed my eyes again, letting the ramifications run through me. Long, pleasurable minutes later, Bruiser said,
Leo has scrapped your idea of having all his people go naked to the opening ceremonies of the Sangre Duello to shock and dismay the EVs.
Thank God, I grinned evilly. Too cold?
Precisely. though he did profess sadness at not being able to see you naked in your half-fighting form.
I opened one eye again and glared. This is the stink eye. Keep it up and I'll give you the stink eye with both eyes.
I consider myself warned.
His brown eyes melted me inside, along with his very, so very talented hands.
The lab has sent a preliminary report of the contents and DNA from the bottle of mixed blood found in the Caruso family funeral services. They have detected the blood of 5 major players, and perhaps a dozen lesser players, all very old and powerful Mithrins, mixed with traces of chemicals, a long list of them. And unlike the usual putrefaction and decomposition of Mithrin blood, these chemicals keep it stable for a long period, months, perhaps years.
I opened my other eye so I could see him with both, this time in concern. Is it drinkable? Can humans or vamps drink it to be turned?
No, but it stops necrosis of flesh, is bactericidal, and speeds healing dramatically.
The U.S. military PTBs would give their accumulated ripe testicles for that formula. Eli told me so. The laughter in Bruiser's eyes went deeper, as if he was envisioning a pile of ripe private parts and a long line of pained military brass.
He said, as would any pharmaceutical company, any foreign power, any billionaire who wants to live forever without becoming bound to a vampire.
I almost said, that sucks. But it would have been funny, and funny didn't fit here.
They have managed to reverse engineer the formula, he said. Leo has personally completed preliminary testing. It works.
And if Leo can reproduce it in quantity, he will have the single most financially lucrative and medically important pharmaceutical product to hit the health profession since penicillin.
Indeed.
Which would give Leo almost unlimited financial revenues until the patent ran out or someone else reverse-engineered it. Right. And Leo would be in terrible danger from outside and inside forces because such a product and such an economic stranglehold would change every financial market in the world. And Leo would have all that power. I sighed. Leo, king of the world. Enough talk. Bruiser put my feet on the sofa, then stood and picked me up and carried me to his bed. Enough talk, indeed. Chapter 13. After I spill some blood and kill some people. Some hours later, as we lay cuddled in blankets with pillows stuffed around and behind us, I said, so Leo isn't gonna do the whole naked bit. But isn't there something else he can do to discombobulate the Eurovamps? Something, I don't know, American, all muscle cars and grease-style hairdos? Bruiser stiffened, rolled over on top of me and kissed me hard.
You are not only beautiful, but you are bloody brilliant. That, my dear girl, is a lovely thought.
On elbows and knees, he rolled from the bed, grabbed his clothes, and was gone before I could think twice. To the empty walls, I said, Onorios can move almost as fast as fangheads. I narrowed my eyes at the ceiling. And I don't have a car. Dang it. But, Bruiser called me beautiful. Wow. I pulled the covers close and fell asleep. I napped for an hour longer and then rolled out of bed feeling pretty dang wonderful. Good enough to check emails, answer texts, and return voicemails. And do some research on Julieta Tempest, head of Clan des Citrons. There wasn't much except that Julieta and her predecessors as Clan Bloodmaster had loved lemons, lemon tea, lemon preserves, and drinking from humans who had eaten large amounts of lemons. I had a blitzkrieg moment. Were lemons grown in Louisiana? And if so, where? I did an online search and discovered that there were 3 nurseries and 2 lemon groves within driving distance of NOLA. One of them had a large B&B called Lemon Grove Farm and B&B. I dressed, making calls and getting Alex to research each of the places, with an emphasis on the bed and breakfast. By the time I got home, Alex had broken through the security system on the B&B and found evidence that vamps had taken over the place. In stored footage from motion detectors, we saw two unmoving bodies on the floor in the kitchen. People were walking past the living room security camera in total unconcern. There was one very clear image of Dominique, another that looked like Sim, and we had a name on the owners. The Stevenses, family of five, and a dog. "When were these acquired by the surveil?" I asked. Alex bent his head over his screens, said, "Last one was last night, 9:27 p.m. Then it looks like they dismantled the system. All cameras are currently offline. I have images of people, most of them human, not vamps, beating the cameras with household tools, a broom, a tire iron, other stuff. They got every single camera, but they forgot to wipe the memory." I made more calls and got a team together. Within an hour, an armed party of Derek's best and I were on the way south and east in a caravan of armored vans. Eli and I took up the entire bench seat behind the driver, our gear and go bags on the floor at our feet, comms units hooked up and tied into the main system at the house, where Alex monitored progress at the B&B and rallied Sideland to meet us there. Over my cell, which was hooked into our comm system, he said to Iotis, "I don't give a flaming pink flamingo if you're busy. My sister and brother are on the way there with an armed team to do your job." I was speed-loading an extra mag with silver lead rounds when the words "flaming pink flamingo" came over the system, and I laughed silently. Eli gave a quirked smile, amusement and pride in his eyes.
"Siled is lead on this, not Jane," Iotis said, his irritation clear. "You inform my sister that she and her team are to stay off-site until we get there."
"There are dead humans in the still shot I sent you," Alex said, his tone inflexible and hard and so very adult. "And this is taking place on Leo's territory, so forgive me if I correct you. Leo has authorized his enforcer to proceed with all haste. His words. I've contacted the state police and passed the information along to the governor's office. Per the MOC, Siled is welcome to take part in the rescue operation. But the enforcer to the master of the city of New Orleans will not be waiting to engage the enemy." And I heard a click.
"Did you just hang up on Firewind?" Eli asked.
"Yeah," Alex said, the words staticky.
"You got a problem with that, my brother?"
"Not at all. Just seeking clarification. Our ETA to the B&B is 12.
Emma pushed his mic away. The van swayed and bumped and thumped its way along the road, which hadn't seen much in the way of repaving since Katrina. The potholes had potholes. Air blew into the cab as we weaponed up and went over the online visuals, which were from older satellite pics. Rassler had a drone ready to launch overhead to acquire on-site visuals of the house and grounds and provide us with more visuals than the ones currently available to us. Except for me, the entry party were all former military and were equipped with mechanical breaching tools and devices, prepared with varied and dynamic techniques to be used based on what we found on the grounds and inside the house. They were armed with shotguns loaded with silver flechette rounds, flashbangs, and vamp killers, among other less lethal weapons. Thanks to the fact that the house was a B&B, we had excellent intel from the online photos, including photos of the basement with its high-placed windows. Basements were rare in South Louisiana, rare enough to make Alex take a good look at the existing pics. A mile out, we pulled over. Into my earbuds, Alex said, calmly, "The house was built in the 1880s, about 20 feet higher than most in the southern part of the state. It was built on an old Indian mound."
"Burial mound?" a voice asked.
"No," Alex said. "The local tribal peoples from as long as 2,000 years ago built mounds to live on. Lots of reasons why.
but the likelihood of the Mississippi and the Atchafalaya and other rivers to flood was probably the reason. No ghosts, he added.
The man who had asked chuckled as if it had been a joke, but he sounded relieved. I heard the soft whir of the drone when it took off and checked the video monitor on my helmet. Rassler said,
Drone visuals on your monitors. Vehicle tracks all through the yard and on the grass. Only one car in the drive. There are no vehicles present with vamp-tinted windows.
That was bad. It meant the likelihood of vamps being on-site had just dropped drastically.
Taking a chance and dropping the drone down to get a closer look, he said.
I had seen sites where vamps had lived and eaten and killed and departed. This had all the markers, from the stuffed mailbox to the tire tracks through the lawn, to the unused and dirty children's swing set out back.
Move out,
Eli said, his voice grim. We were out of the van and jogging through the underbrush, down the road, moving out in a fan, and into our assigned positions. I followed Eli up the mound into the winter dormant foliage that covered a low wall near the carport. I could still smell jasmine. The team began to call in with their op names and positions acquired. One voice added,
Meyer lemon trees fruit year-round. These should be producing, and they've been stripped of fruit. All fruit, not just the ripe ones, recently.
I took a breath, mouth open, drawn in air over my tongue and through my nose with a soft scree of sound. I covered my mic and said to Eli, Death, several days old, multiple people. I don't smell or hear activity. He covered his mic and said, Copy that.
Didn't know you could smell activity.
I shrugged. It wasn't something I could explain. It fell under a category of weird, like people who could walk into a house and tell if anyone had been there recently. Movement of air currents, presence or absence of faint sounds or echoes, whatever. Eli said,
Tracks in the yard are hours old. I think they bugged out.
And left the bodies, I said.
We were both right. By the time Siled got there, we had called the coroner and left the house to the five human corpses and the dead dog. I didn't want to think about what De Citron had done to the people in the B&B. But I knew this. I'd kill them when I found them. I sent a text to Alex. Make sure this was a random kill site, no attachment to Leo or any clan. He sent back, Roger that. The kid was growing up. 5 hours after I leaped out of bed to go to war with De Citron, Shemmy dropped me off at home. Eli had reached the house an hour before, and I envied him the hot shower he had undoubtedly taken, as I entered the house, hearing the sound of hammers and a skill saw from the third floor, and men talking from the living room. Neither group heard me, so I stopped in the shadows of the door to eavesdrop. Edmund said,
Titus agreed to the location and proposed the first round combatants. His people and Leo's are close to deciding on a time to begin.
Thank you, he interjected, as if he'd been given a glass of wine or a really good cookie.
Leo dispatched Derek Lee and an initial security crew, his entire housekeeping crew, and the combined and motley gangs of tattooed and disreputable-looking carpenters, electricians, and plumbers to the accepted house.
Security is Jane's and Yellow Rock Security's job, Alex said.
Why weren't we sent? Derek is taking a scouting team, Ed said. Jane is too important in the search for De Citron to waste her talents watching carpenters ripping into walls and floors.
But if Jane's there, she'll make sure we have indoor plumbing and hot showers,
the kid said.
Showers? We don't need no stinking showers, Beaudet said.
Forgive my saying so, Edmund said. But that is incorrect. You both need showers. Quite desperately. What did Jane used to call you?
Number two? When she called my bro number one?
She called you shit? Dude.
Beaudet, shut up,
Alex said, sounding tired.
What? What'd I say?
Stinky, Eli said,
his voice with that zen modulation it acquired when he was cleaning his weapons.
Which will call you again if you don't go up right now and shower, both of you.
Jeez, you people,
Beaudet said.
Upstairs, Alex interrupted. Let's get cleaned up and you packed. Your bus leaves for the last inhabitable room in the toe of the state in half an hour. If you're not in place, we can't set up cell or satellite and Wi-Fi on the island.
I stepped back into my bedroom doorway.
But what I say,
Beaudet complained as they passed me without seeing me in the shadows.
Things will be more primitive than usual, Edmund said. I've seen the house, though that was over 60 years ago. Old-fashioned bathrooms and only two of them. No central heating or air conditioning. The bedrooms without windows are limited, so Mithrins will be sleeping several to a room. Humans will have only 3 or 4 rooms to choose from, mostly bunk bed-style sleeping areas, if I recall. Ancient furniture.
Eli said,
George thinks we'll leave for the island fast, and the duello will start in less than 2 days.
When Edmund said nothing, Eli asked too casually,
have you seen the proposed list of elimination rounds?
Edmund didn't answer.
That bad?
He asked.
Everyone wants to fight Jane. Every single one of the Europeans,
Edmund said at last.
From Titus's sous chef to his primo.
I heard soft clicks and snaps as Eli worked, growing more noisy than usual. Edmund's admission had disturbed him.
Show me.
I had seen the list. I wanted to blow off steam. I slipped into my room and changed into exercise gear. Tight, lycra-based running pants and a padded sports bra. Bare feet. I walked into the living room and pointed at Eli.
Spar, now.
Then at Edmund. And when I wipe the floor with him, it'll be your turn.
Edmund's lips lifted faintly.
As my mistress desires.
I didn't even bother to fuss about the mistress comment. I turned on my toes and raced up the stairs across the construction mess into the bedroom with the sparring mats and faced away from the door toward the windows. I let my body loosen. I breathed, let my mind stop, relaxed until a white haze filled my brain and body, not silent, but a place, a state of mind, an existence without sight, texture, or sound. An absence of sensation. Then I let it bleed back into me. A rubberized mat covered the wood floor. I let my soles feel the mat, the cushioned perception of weight, of gravity. I smelled the chemicals that composed the mat, heard water come on in the showers, and I heard Eli enter the room. So silent, a wakened cat wouldn't have heard him. The air moved, smelling of Eli. I ducked, dropped, opened my eyes, captured my balance on one foot in both fists, swung the other leg out and around. Missed him. Took a blow to my rib cage that sent me into the wall. I laughed. It sounded not quite right. I launched myself at him, took a blow to my abdomen, block, 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 strike, strike, blow, block. Pain woke me up. My fists tightened, my crouch deepened a quarter inch, and I attacked fast, fast, fast. Beast chuffed through my throat. Eli's heel came at my throat, killing strike, knowing I would dodge, because I was faster than Eli. Always had been. Time stopped. And then I was standing in the room, eyes closed, back to the door, and I smelled Eli. I dropped and rolled, shouting, Edmund! He was instantly in the doorway, the little pop of sound that announced a vamp moving fast. My eyes were wide. Eli, in attack position, was staring at me. I slammed my spine to the wall and foot-crawled hard to stand against it.
Jane?
Eli said.
What?
Time did something. I already had a fight with you, and now we're starting over. Something's wrong. A spike of pain lanced through my head, and I remembered Time doing something weird with Leo recently. Tears welled over and fell from my eyes, scoured down my cheeks.
though whether from what was happening or from the memories of the tortured bodies of the Stevens family at the B&B, I didn't know. My skull spiked with pain and I wanted to hurl. I put one hand to my head and one to my belly, which felt hard and tight. Something's very, very wrong. I'll make tea, my mistress, Edmund said. Eli, come with me, please. Eli looked like he didn't want to go, but he followed Edmund. They left me there, alone in the spare bedroom with the fighting mats, the stench of rubber, and a body that hurt, as if I'd been beaten. In the kitchen, Edmund was preparing a fast cup of chai in the bun coffee maker. Eli was sitting at the table. I pulled an afghan off the couch and wrapped it around me, ignoring that it smelled of Bodat and pizza. I was cold. I watched them. They seemed fine. I sat at my usual place. No one said anything. Upstairs, one shower went off. I hadn't heard it come on in this timeline. Ed placed the mug of spiced tea in front of me. The cup was one with a saying on it. I don't need anger management, I just need people to stop pissing me off. The tea had a thick layer of frothed cream on top. My tears, which had stopped, gathered again at the kindness. I wrapped my icy fingers around the mug and lifted it from the table. Sipped. The frothed cream made it perfect. The tea and cream were delicious and quickly helped my belly pain to ease. Ed put two Tylenol on the table and I took them without argument. Jane, Edmund said, when my mug was half empty, tell us what happened. I gave them a blow-by-block-by-blow description of what I had experienced. They said nothing. I sipped. They looked at each other. Something about the exchange hit me as wrong, but I couldn't place it. Did Beast do the time change? Edmund asked. Your eyes were glowing gold when I got to the sparring room. But I turned my thoughts inward. Beast stared at me a moment, turned away and patted paw, paw, paw into the darkness of our minds. Maybe, I whispered, thinking, remembering, especially remembering the last big fight between Eurovamps and our side, in a warehouse where a weather witch had been forced to create storms and to collect arc-en-ciels for their time-walking magic. What if it wasn't just me who had messed up time? What if it had been Beast too, and the witch Adon, and the arc-en-ciel trapped in the anode of crystals that same night? That possibility hit me like a Mack truck. What if it had been all of us, in tiny little changes back along our shared timeline? And the pain in my head and belly might be contributing to it, too. My messed up genetics switching on and off, changing things around me. We might all be screwed six ways from Sunday. Edmund brought coffee to the table and poured me a second hot cup of tea. I heard the whirring sound of a new stirring device in the background before he added a froth of cream to my cup. I was a long way from Cool Whip. Hammers and buzzes of saws from the third floor grew loud, and a sound like a stack of lumber dropped from a height shook the house. Eli's body twitched, and I could tell he wanted to check on the men upstairs. But he drank his coffee instead, his eyes on me. Remember the fight in the warehouse, I said, after I drank through the cream. Adon Bouvier was in a magical cage, working storm magic, blood-starved, pretty much insane. There was an arc-en-ciel trapped in the crystal, cerulean. Adon was using her to alter time. Beast. My beast seems able to twist time, too. I wasn't doing anything with time, and yet I kept losing moments. Odd little things that I didn't notice immediately, but that added up to me being uncertain about the sequence of events. That happens in battle, Eli said, especially after you've been in a few firefights. You lose some things. Memories will skip from event to event like a stone on still water. Others are so detailed and brilliant and sharp they play out for you like you're going through it all over again. Like you're experiencing it again? I asked.
In a way. For me, it's always clearly a memory. But it can be intense and comprehensive and meticulous in detail.
Since the warehouse fight, I've noticed small bits of time stuttering. Or two events that happened in different ways. But they both feel real. I sipped some more.
I have called Sol, my mistress, Edmund said, bowing his head. She and G will be here soon.
My fingers clenched on the warm mug.
Why?
Though I knew the answer.
Because they and Brute are the only other time walkers we know.
As if they knew that Ed had told me they were coming, as if they'd waited for the words to be spoken, a knock sounded on the front door. Ed let them in, murmured words of greeting and explanation.
They don't know about Beast,
Eli said, his voice so low I could barely hear him.
You want me to stay while you talk? If not, I'll give you private.
Stay, I said. My voice sounded a little pleading, which should have ticked me off, but didn't. He nodded, looked up as our guests entered the kitchen. Sol sat to my left, her billowy clothing shades of misty gray that darkened into purple near her feet. G, looking taller, more muscular, took a seat at the foot of the table, his hair longer and blacker. The changes were an easy adjustment for his glamour.
He said, "The little goddess is evolving."
"Am I?"
"We hunted together. You flew in the form of my friend."
I had taken the form of Anzu and flown into the far north with G. de Merci. We had hunted were-creatures who had killed humans. Sabina said it would be okay, but Skinwalker tradition teaches us that if we take the form of a sentient being, that's the first step into darkness. Am I evolving into Utlunta? Is that what this time-changing thing is?
Utlunta does not evolve. You did not take the form of a living body. You did not eat the body while it was alive so that you might also take the memories and the dreams and the hopes. This is what Utlunta does to take the path into darkness, Sol said,
which was more than I had ever been told or figured out on my own.
You did not make of her a victim. That is not why time is slipping.
Slipping? That, or time walkers were playing with time all around me, or using me as a focus to affect their own changes on the future, if that was even possible.
Then why is time slipping?
Some physicists suggest that our universe is one of an ever-growing stack of universes,
G said.
A new one created each time we make even the smallest choice.
I stared at my cup. Right. So I'm slipping into a different universe?
I don't think so, G said. I think you are reinventing this one in small personal moments.
Unconsciously, Sol said. It can be done by accident,
and it is very, very dangerous.
By accident. That sucked. I thought about that. About all the things that had happened to me since I came to New Orleans and went to work for Leo. I had changed. Maybe too much. Maybe so much that I was trying to undo some of the changes. Subconsciously, by accident, or... Crap. What if it was happening even in my sleep? No. No way. I slowed my breathing, forced calm into me. Edmund appeared and placed a cup of tea in front of Sol and a cup of spiced coffee at G's elbow.
You're not their servant, I snapped. You're the heir to the master of the city.
I am also hospitable to guests, my mistress.
There was censure in his tone, mild but there. I blew out a breath that was too aggravated to be a sigh and drained my mug. Sorry. I set the ceramic mug on the table with a small thump. You're right. Ed replaced my mug with a fresh one. Chai, frothed cream on top. I was an ass. Thank you, Edmund, I said, in my best Bethel Christian Children's Home manners. The tea is delicious. Ed didn't reply. I said,
Sol, if my DNA started forming new strands, would that make it possible that I'd slip into time-walking without intent, even unconscious intent? The room was very still. Upstairs, two men were arguing over a measurement. One of them called the other a shithead. I'd have to say something. We didn't cuss in this house. But I didn't get up. I stared at my mug instead.
How has your DNA changed? Sol whispered.
It's got an extra strand. Maybe two.
I see, Sol said.
Time walkers from this world often have peculiar genetics. Some have fallen into time slipping. What happened to them?
I've known only a few.
Two vanished. One died of very fast-acting malignancies. The others lived long lives and died happy, surrounded by friends and family. The last part sounded like a lie, but it also sounded good, so I let it stand. How did they survive?
They learned self-control. They learned to be happy in spite of illness, pain, war, pestilence, and death.
Drink your tea, my mistress,
Ed said softly. I drank my tea. Self-control. That was something my housemothers had tried to pound into me growing up. Is there a class I can take? I asked, a small smile trying to find my lips. Maybe an online course? I'm kind of busy right now, but I'm highly motivated and ready to learn. Sol smiled with me.
This has happened only when you are fighting, in danger, when others you love are in danger.
This time Eli kicked just as I stood. His foot was coming for my throat, killing strike. He hadn't even pulled the kick yet, and he was about to impact. Eli's eyes tightened, a minuscule move as if a single nerve twitched. To him, I said, yes, I was going to avoid the kick, but my brain said otherwise. To Sol, I said, so far as I've noticed, it's battle. When I think I'm about to be injured, muscle memory takes over. I'm fighting. Then things are different, little things, but I stopped again, remembering when Ayata shot me. Beast had stopped time then. I frowned, wondering how much she contributed to time slippage. Could anything be considered insignificant when it came to stopping time?
You must not lose focus, Sol said. When fighting, you must remain rooted to the earth, your center of gravity aligned with the earth's. You must fight with the concentration of meditation.
Zen, Eli said. The Zen of warfare. The knowledge that battle is taking place around you. That you are in the middle of it. But without leaving the inviolability of your own concentration.
Eli read books on war and fighting, strategy and tactics, the mindset of the warrior. You think that'll work?
I've known a few guys in my life who could do that. They're all dead.
Did they have a long life and die happy, surrounded by friends and family? I asked.
Sure.
A lie. Lots of lies floating in the air. Thank you for coming, I said to Sol and G. I appreciate the effort, the time, and the wisdom you shared with me. And that was pure Tsalagi. Way better than the house mother's prattle. They said their goodbyes and left, Edmund letting them into the night and shutting the door.
Let's spar, Eli said. You can practice meditating and I'll practice hurting you.
That sounds like a good idea, except that I'm so full of tea I'd slosh. But I was thinking that I didn't have time to learn a whole new way to fight in time for the bloody battles.
Go pee and meet me in the workout room. And this time you'll know I don't mean to hurt you. You'll keep that uppermost in your mind. You have to be able to control this before the firefight.
He meant the Sangre Duello. Eli got up and left, his feet silent on the stairs. Edmund came to the table. He stood beside me, placing his hand on my shoulder.
The Sangre Duello will soon be over. For good or ill, all our lives will change. And you can rest. Take a, what is the American word? Retreat. A strategic withdrawal. You can ride Bitsa into your mountains and heal.
That's a good idea. I had taken a break once, when Bitsa was being built. I'd nearly been beheaded and was so close to death that it took a long time to get well. I'd hunted and slept and eaten a lot of game, shifted as often as I needed to continue healing.
You haven't ridden Bitsa since you came back with her, Edmund said.